Well, we are continuing our journey through the life of Jesus, and I do realize that for some of us here, you hear me say that every week, right? But we say it every week because maybe it's your first time here, you would know that, or you're watching online later and you don't know this. So what we want you to know is that we are taking this long journey through Jesus's life. We started in the December of 2024, entering the birth of Jesus, those pre-birth stories. And we're still going strong. And by the way, it's getting there. Within two months, we will finally be to the final week of Jesus' life. It's been a long time getting there. And just because we get to the final week does not mean it's almost over. A lot happens that week. A lot happens the last 24 hours, and we only get one time a week to talk about it, so it's going to take us a while. But we're within 2 months of arriving to the final week of his life when he enters Jerusalem that week, and at the end of the week, he dies and rises again. We're getting there. But today, we're still on that journey to there. And I want to look at something that today that will remind us of things that Jesus has said over the last couple Sundays in our sermons. A couple weeks ago, we saw a story where Jesus ends it by saying in Matthew 19, verse 30, he says, "But many who are the greatest now will be least important then, and those who seem least important now will be the greatest then." Like, what's that about? That seems all weird and least then, great now, great. I mean, what in the world? Jesus made that clear. We talked about it then. Then last week, he made a similar statement. Matthew 20, verse 16, he says, "So those who are last now will be first then, and those who are first will be last." And so more talk like that. What does he mean? It's like it's all upside down, in the upside down. The Demogorgon's around somewhere, right? And there's 12 disciples, but Judas is going to leave and die, so then there'll be 11. So these are stranger things for sure. And so, I mean, anyhow, but I don't know what's going on, but here's the deal. Everything seems upside down, and Jesus is making a reference here to something he's going to touch on again in today's story. I want us to see it together today. Now, we're going to largely be in Mark chapter 10 if you want to follow along. We'll briefly look at a verse or two in Matthew, but we're basically going to spend all our time in Mark 10. So that's the place to be if you want to get somewhere. And we'll look at the story today together. Before I get started in the story, here's what's happening. Jesus is getting near Jerusalem, again, for that final week. He's arriving soon for the final week where he will die and rise again at the end of it. He's not there yet. He's been going there for a long time. If you've been coming to Lighthouse for a while, months ago, we saw him leaving Galilee up north to head to Judea for this last trip to Jerusalem. And it's taken us a long time to get there because, number one, we only have one service a week to cover these stories, but also because he makes a lot of stops along the way on this final trip to Jerusalem. He helps people, heals people, teaches people, feeds people, does all his stuff all the way down to his last destination. And he's getting close. And along the way, if you've been with us, you know this, or if you've read the scriptures, you know this, that along the way, several times, Jesus kept telling his disciples, "They're going to take me, I'm going to be crucified, I'm going to die and rise again." And they never seemed to be able to wrap their minds around that. That was troubling. It's just, why would you say that? Why would that happen? And so when Jesus would explain what was going to happen to him, they would do weird things. Like one time they scolded him. They're like, "Don't talk that way." Another time they just got sad and quiet. Another time they changed the subject. But he kept trying to help them see and prepare them for what was coming so that it wouldn't rock their world as bad. It's going to rock their world, but they'd be braced because he warned them. And so he's getting close to Jerusalem. He warns them one more time in this passage, Mark chapter 10, starting with verse 33. Jesus says, "Listen." Makes me feel good. I say the word "listen" a lot. I realize that's one of my tics. So Jesus says it here. It feels good. "Listen," he said, "we're going up to Jerusalem where the Son of Man will be betrayed to the leading priests and the teachers of religious law. They will sentence him to die and hand him over to the Romans." He says the same thing he's been saying. "My own people will turn the religious crowd who's been envious of my ministry because it doesn't fit into their box of how you're supposed to worship God, and they think I'm dangerous, and they think I've got too much of a following, and they hate it. So they're going to betray me. They're going to arrest me. They're going to beat me. They're going to condemn me and hand me to the Romans." He's just telling the same story he's told before, but it's getting a little more specific and a little bit more intense because he's trying to make them sure, be ready. Look what he adds in verse 34. He says, they will mock him, spit on him, flog him with a whip, and kill him. But after 3 days, he will rise again. Again, heavy, heavy things he's telling them. And the hope is that they're going to hear it one of these times. The hope is that maybe if he gives them a few moments of silence that they can think through that and maybe a little while later come and ask him questions to lean into that and prepare their hearts. But what's going to happen is they're not going to do that again. Someone's going to change the subject. Have you ever poured out your heart to somebody, shared something that was very vulnerable to you with them, only to have them just change the subject right after you just opened up so vulnerably? That's awkward, isn't it? Like, they changed the subject, and yet, why did they do that? Maybe because they didn't know what to say, they felt awkward, and they weren't sure what to say to you, so they just changed the subject. Or maybe they didn't care. That's our fears. They don't care, right? Maybe they don't. Or maybe they just have ADHD, and they saw a squirrel, and they just went over, something happened. I don't know. But sometimes you're like, man, I opened my heart up to you, and you didn't stay with me, and I'm not going to do that again. Maybe you think, I'm going to not be that open again, because I don't think, it mattered. And Jesus has just become vulnerable. He's just retold the story of what's going to happen to him when they get to Jerusalem for the umpteenth time. And what happens afterwards, after maybe a few minutes of reflection, is two of his disciples come and have a weird conversation with him. Let's read about it. In verse 35, it says, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came over and spoke to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do us a favor. Let's talk about this. Who are these brothers? James and John are two brothers who were fishermen before they followed Jesus. They are, James is the older brother. John is probably the youngest of the 12 disciples. They're all pretty young, really, but John's probably the youngest of them. And they were fishermen with their father Zebedee, who owned a fishing boat and fished on the Sea of Galilee next to Simon Peter. Maybe they were even in some partnership together. Simon Peter, who owned his own boat and fished with his brother Andrew. And that's what they did for a living. Peter's boat, Zebedee's boat, their families working together to make a living. Jesus showed up one day. We saw this long time ago. Jesus showed up one day, gets on the fishing boat of Peter, uses it as a platform to teach some crowds that had gathered on the seashore. And afterwards, he calls Peter and Andrew to leave their nets and follow him. And they did. And then he looks at James and John at their father Zebedee's boat and says, you guys follow me too. And they did. Their dad was glad to let them. He says, go for it. And they left their nets and, follow the rabbi. And they followed Jesus. They became four of the closest disciples. But these two brothers, James and John, sons of Zebedee, were also known by another nickname. Does anybody here know what the other nickname that James and John were given? Anybody? Sons of Thunder, Brenda. Thank you very much. That's great. The Sons of Thunder, which means their father was Thor. If you want to know what it was, Zebedee looked a lot like Chris Hemsworth, if you want to know what he looked like. They're Sons of Thunder. Why were they called the Sons of Thunder? Well, we don't know exactly why, but the TV series, The Chosen, or the series The Chosen, which Brenda, by the way, served as an extra. She's in one of their seasons, season 5, I think, or something. And The Chosen tells a story from the scriptures where James and John may have helped solidify that nickname. It's a story I want to rewind and tell you real quick to give you context. We saw it months ago. The story was that Jesus was beginning this long trip to Jerusalem for his final his crucifixion. That he's getting close there now in today's story. But rewind to an earlier time, he was on that long journey from Galilee, making lots of stops along the way to help people. One day they came to a village of Samaritan people. And Samaritan and Jewish people did not always get along for lots of reasons. Some were racial. The Samaritans were half Jewish, and there was a lot of bad animosity about why that was. There was political reasons. There was religious reasons, and they were deep, and they didn't get along very well at all. And sometimes people were cordial anyways, but sometimes they were not. And when Jesus and his disciples showed up to that Samaritan village, they were on their way to Jerusalem, and when the people there heard it, they're like, we hate Jerusalem. And by the way, for understandable reasons. We could rehash those, but they don't matter. They had big hurts in their past. And so they looked at Jesus and his disciples and said, leave. We don't serve your type in our restaurants. We have no room in our lodging. Go. And so they did. It's embarrassing to be escorted out of town. It's humiliating. It's rejecting. No one wants to feel that way. And it's so hurtful that James and John get mad, these young men. And they look at Jesus and they say, you know what we should do? We should do what Elijah did in our ancient history of Israel. Remember Elijah the prophet in the Hebrew scriptures? How he prayed down fire from heaven one time, as the story goes, and consumed a whole bunch of people. Let's pray down fire from heaven, Jesus, and consume those people for not letting us stay in their village. And Jesus is like, what are you going on about? You want me to call fire? Really, fellas? That's what you want me to do? You think that's the answer? Like, these people had animosity that's deeply rooted in their past. They did not reject Jesus and his disciples because of them. It was much bigger reasons, much deeper issues. That happens to all of us, by the way, sometimes, don't we? Sometimes we face people who, they hurt us, or they hurt our feelings, or they say something, and we take it so personal, but the problem is it's probably not personal to them. There's probably deeper reasons why that's going on, and we forget to understand why. We just take it personally. And Jesus is like, you guys are upset. They're not mad at James and John and Jesus particularly. They're upset because of the history behind their groups. And they just happen to fall on the wrong side of the issue. So they're leaving, and these guys want to call fire from heaven, and Jesus is like, you guys don't understand, do you? You're following me, but you're not getting the message. I didn't come here to judge humanity. I came to save humanity. I didn't come here to kill people. I came here to die for people. And you want me to call fire from heaven? I think you're missing the boat. Fellas, it's time to get with it. And so they were called the sons of thunder. And we can go on about that for more time than we have for. But James and John were two of the three most inner circle of Jesus' disciples. So Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John went places that nobody else went to. They got into certain rooms that no one else got into, even the other disciples. They got certain mountaintop experiences that only they got into. They were the three special, they were teacher's pets, as you would say in today's class. Which is why it's funny when they come to Jesus here and they said, teacher, got an apple for your desk, and we have a special favor to ask of you, teacher. And so they're asking him a favor. He's just been talking about how he's going to die and suffer. And they're like, that's interesting, but we have a favor to ask you. Verse 36, what is your request? Jesus asked. They replied, when you sit on your glorious throne, we want to sit in places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on your left. That's their question. Folks, that's so awkward. Jesus is just talking about what bad things he's about to suffer for everybody, trying to have a conversation. And they're like, Hey, listen, when all that stuff that we don't understand is over, and it all works out in the end, because I'm sure it will, and you're on your glorious throne, we want to sit next to you. You know, there's only two spots next to you. We want them. And you can have the biggest chair, because you're big boy Jesus in the high chair, but we want the ones next to you, so people come and give you attention. They'll see us too, and, you know, we'll just help soak it up. Can we do that? Now, folks, that's awkward. It's awkward to ever ask that question. It's especially awkward to ask that question after what Jesus was just talking about going through. And this is what they're bringing up. But as awkward as it is, it's not even the worst part. It gets more cringy. Don't you love a good cringy story? It gets more cringy than that. Because Matthew tells us a detail that Mark leaves out. I don't know why Mark leaves it out. Mark's version of the story largely comes from Peter. Peter tells the story, and Mark records the story of being around Jesus. And so why did Peter not tell this other detail? Maybe because he just wants to lay the responsibility squarely at James and John's feet. Or maybe because, I don't know why. But Matthew is going to be like writing his version of the same story, and he's going to go like, actually, there's something else you should know. And so let's quickly look over at Matthew and read that same part of the story with the extra detail. Are you ready? Matthew 20, verse 20 says, then the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus with her sons. She now respectfully to ask a favor. So now we know that when they came to Jesus for this request, they didn't come by themselves. They came with mama. Now we know it's not her idea because they come with her. It says right here. And as Mark says, it was their request. But they come with her, and she kneels before them, and she asks a favor. Verse 21, what is your request? He asked. She replied, "In your kingdom, please let my two sons sit in places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on your left." So mom was asking the question. Now, so apparently what happens when we put the stories together is this is James and John's request, but they share it with mom, and mom's like, "Don't worry, son, boys, mama knows how to get things done." She takes them by the hands and says, "Let's go see Jesus." And they're with her. It would be, look, if she would have gone apart behind their back and said, "Hey, my boys don't know I'm here, but can you give them special seats?" And they heard about it later. Most of us would be like, "Mom, what you do? Don't, OMG, don't do that to me." You know, but in this case, they're with her. It's their request. Mark makes that clear. And she just says, "Mama gets things done. You come with me. I'll take it." She has by the hand. She goes to Jesus. She's going to work her magic. "Hey, Jesus, you know, by the way, hope you enjoy that friendship bread I made for you and passed around the original dough to somebody else and kept it going. And those essential oils, you can keep those also. But hey, listen, here's the dealio. My boys, aren't they sweet?" Pinches their cheeks. "My boys are awesome. And I know you love them. And they deserve a special seat. Can they sit right next to you forever? I'm asking you as a mama, I'm asking you for my boys. Look at, flex your muscles, boys, show them your muscles. Ooh, they would be great there." Folks, that's just cringy. If you don't think that's cringy, you're either a mama who would do that for your kids or something. But most of us, men and women alike, are gonna be like, "That would be weird." But James and John were all for it. They were there. And I don't know what they looked like. We don't have ancient pictures, but it's interesting. The technology we have today has gotten so advanced that we can take ancient things we find and then sculptures that we find, and we can recreate what people looked like. And we have recreated an ancient picture of what this mother and one of her sons looks like. We'll put it on the screen for you right here. This is her and, I don't know if it's Jimmy or Johnny, but she's like, "My boys are so wonderful. Look what I can do." You know, this is them. So anyhow, but what an awkward exchange is going on. So Jesus is going to address the problem now. And he's going to talk to the boys. In both Matthew and Mark's account, he's going to talk to the boys and not to mama. So let's read about that together in Mark. Back to Mark chapter 10. Are you ready? Mark 10, verse 38. "But Jesus said to them," he says, "You don't know what you're asking." You ever want to say to somebody, "You don't know what you're talking about"? He's like, "You guys do not know what you are asking me. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering that I am about to drink?" In other words, when I get to the Jerusalem soon and I do what I just told you I was going to do when I get there, I was going to be betrayed and condemned and beaten and killed and die and rise again. Are you able to drink from that bitter cup? And it was a bitter cup of suffering. Jesus, by the way, when he got to there, the end of that week in Jerusalem, he's going to go to the Garden of Gethsemane and pray one last time before he's arrested. And he's going to pray a prayer and say, "Father, if there's any way possible, let this cup of suffering pass away from me. However," then he says, "if I must drink of it for your will to be done, then your will and not my will be done." He's wrestling with this as he's telling them about it, and they're asking about special seats someday. He's like, "Are you able to drink from this bitter cup of suffering I'm going to drink from? Let's talk about that. Or are you able to be baptized with a baptism of suffering I must be baptized with?" He says, "Fellas, you want to talk about the glory someday, but before the glory comes the gory, okay? You need to know that." Paul the Apostle, a couple decades later, Paul the Apostle would write a letter to the believers in the city of Philippi. And here's what Paul would say about this. Paul would say that we should let the mindset be in us that was in Christ Jesus, who though he was equal with God, left his divine privilege aside and came to earth in an unassuming way and served humanity and took upon the form of a servant and humbled himself, obedient to death, even the death of the cross. And Paul says, therefore, because of that, God has highly exalted him and has given him a name above all names, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue will confess that he is Lord. But Paul says that comes after the path that he is called to walk. And Jesus is like, "You guys are all interested in that glory, but are you able to join me in the gory? Like, you want to sit on my throne someday, my left and my right side, but how about when I'm hanging on the cross? Do you want to be on my left side and my right side there as well? Do you know what I'm doing? You know the bigger cause that I'm serving for the world. Are you interested in that, and are you able to do that?" Pretty pointed question. Verse 39, "Oh yes," they replied, "we are able." Show them those muscles again, boys. We're able. And I'm sure that Jesus, we know the story, we know what happens next. Jesus had to know what's going to happen. They were sure of themselves, but they would not be ready when it came time. Because if you go ahead and Jesus knows the story, you look ahead a little further, and what happens is when Jesus is in that garden praying that prayer, and they come to arrest him, and they realize what's about to happen to him, every single person of those disciples, including James and John, they run and they hide. That's right, Aura. They run and they hide. Because you know why? Because they're not ready to drink that cup, be baptized with that suffering. They're not. And Jesus then says, Jesus is going to prophesy over them. He's going to speak over their lives. Then Jesus told them, "You will indeed drink from my bitter cup and be baptized with my baptism of suffering." He says, "You will be." Now, not then, not when he's crucified. They weren't ready for it then. But Jesus is looking ahead further. He's looking ahead to when he ultimately one day will die and rise again, and that will change everything. Because you know all of the disciples, including James and John, do you know what happens? They finally figure things out. They finally figure things out after the resurrection. It took until that time for them to really understand what he was saying. They struggled. But when he died and rose again, they're like, oh. And then they're all in. Then they're giving their lives. Then they're just serving. Then they're saying, we don't care about death. Who cares about death anymore? We saw someone die. We watched him die and rise again. I mean, John showed back up for the crucifixion and watched him on the cross and took his mother in as his own mom. And then they watched him all of a sudden alive and well a few days later. And they're like, you know what? We're all in. So in the end, not when Jesus is crucified, but someday James and John will drink the bitter cup of suffering. They will be baptized with suffering someday. Not when Jesus goes to the cross, though. And Jesus is predicting that. And those predictions come true. The scriptures will tell us in the book of Acts that James is beheaded. He's imprisoned by one of the Herods, and his head gets cut off. Not a very good day. On top of that, John historically is dipped in boiling oil, exiled to the Isle of Patmos. He suffers tremendously. They will suffer for the name of Jesus and for the good news of the gospel. And Jesus tells them ahead of time, that day will come, but you're not ready for that yet. When you are ready for it, I won't be able to stop you. You'll be so enthusiastic to suffer and die for a good message. But you're not there yet. But then Jesus says in verse 40, he says, "But I have no right to say who will sit on my right or my left. God has prepared those places for the ones he has chosen." He says, here's the deal. I can't give you those chairs. That's your request. I can't give them. It belongs to my Father to do that. It's above my pay grade. Those seats are not mine to give. Which means Lighthouse Church and those watching online, guess what? Maybe they're still up for grabs. You can pray the prayer if you want the path that takes you there. Well, I'd love to tell you the story ends there, but it doesn't, because what happens next is noteworthy. Verse 41, it says, "When the 10 other disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant." Now, why were they indignant? There's two reasons they could be upset. One reason they could be upset is because they're mad for Jesus. You defamed his name. I mean, he was telling about how he's going to die for our sins, and you're over here making it about you and glory someday. That'd be a good reason to be indignant. But the real reason they were indignant was pride. That's right. They wanted those chairs. They had the audacity to ask him first. Listen, you read the stories for yourself. These last few days' journey to Jerusalem, the disciples, we're going to see it later, the disciples keep arguing with each other about which of them is the greatest. I'm the greatest. And so when James and John ask to sit in the special seat someday, they're indignant because how dare you? Who do you think you are? I was lobbying. I wouldn't have asked him. I wouldn't have brought my mama, but I was hoping, you know. So they're indignant for selfish reasons. Peter's over there like, "Hello, I'm the original disciple, I think, here, and I'm definitely the leader of the pack, so I think I should sit in one of those seats someday." And then Andrew might be like, "I'm Peter's brother, so I think I should sit in the other one." And then Matthew's like, I was a tax collector. That's a good career behind to come do this. I think I should sit in one of those seats. And then Nathaniel, who's later called Bartholomew, says, Jesus called me an innocent man in whom there's no deceit. I think I should sit in one of those seats. And then Philip's like, well, you know, actually, I'm the one who found Nathaniel and brought him to Jesus, so I think I should sit in one of those seats. And then Thomas is like, I doubt I'll sit there. Probably not me. Who knows? But I don't know. But they're all like arguing about whose spot that's going to be. And they're indignant. And Jesus needs to sit them down and have a hard conversation with them. You ever realize that the future of your operation is depending upon people that don't feel very ready? You're like, my company, I'm going to leave it on someone else's hands when I retire soon, or you know, I'm preparing the next generation for this or that, or I'm starting something in my business or my charity work. And you're like, they're not ready. This is the future. Oh my goodness. So Jesus is like, these guys are bickering, and he's like, I got to sit them down. I know they're going to figure it out later. When Jesus dies and rises again, they'll figure it out. But he's like, I got to say some things to prepare their mindset because this ain't it, man. So in verse 42, it says, Jesus called them together and he said, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. Right? That's how the world works. People get in power, so people, they can flaunt it. People can serve them. People are under them. People who are not in positions of authority kiss up to hopefully get treated better or get a position of authority, and then they find the next person to kiss up to, go as high as they can on the ladder of authority so that someday they could be in charge and people could kiss up to them and they can have people serve their desires and their needs because I'm in charge. Because that's how the world can often work. Climb the ladder. Look out for number one. And Jesus says, you know that's how it goes. But then he makes this statement in verse 43. He says, but among you, it will be different. This is powerful. Jesus says, you're following me. I don't want you to be conformed to this world. Being conformed to this world has nothing to do with the way you wear your hairstyle or the outfit you wear or the music you like. It has to do with how we live like Jesus in this world, how we serve and treat others the way he did. Every time Jesus refers to that or the scriptures refer, there's context like this. Every time, but we miss that. He says, don't be conformed to this world. I want you to march to my drum. I've come to live a different way in this world. I've come to show a better way. He said, I want you to understand something here, that if you're going to believe in me, great, but if you're going to follow me, this is what it looks like. That in my kingdom, which I'm living out, those are the values I want you to live out. Not just when you get to some magical, happy place someday and it's all better. I want you to adopt my views and live them out and bring them into this world. I want your prayer to be, Lord, may your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I want you to follow me. It's countercultural. It's different. It's upside down. What does this mean? It'll be different with you. He explains in verse 43. He says, whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. Well, that sounds terrible. I don't like that. I want to be a leader so that people can serve me. I want to be first so that I can be the head, not the tail, so people can slave after my needs and look after me. I want people to meet my desires. I don't want to be worrying about what their desires and needs are. And I want to look out for number one. But he says, it's countercultural. It's different with you. It's upside down. This world can be dog eat dog, survival of the fittest, look out for number one, climb as high as you can climb and win at all cost. But with you, I'm saying serve and sacrifice and care and give. And don't pray fire from heaven down upon people who hurt your feelings. You love them and care for them and make a difference through your service. He's calling us to something very different. I feel like it's the one we all need to hear. I think the church needs to hear it today. I think we have learned to operate on multiple frames, whether it's personal, athletic, political, religious, on a competitive level that mimics the world's style. So you gotta fight evil with evil. You gotta be like this way. You gotta be like that. You gotta fight be like the world to win in the world. We're not trying to win in the world. We're trying to be like Jesus and make a true difference. But it's hard because who wants to do that? Someone else might come out on top and not you. And Jesus said, I'm not just telling you something. I'm modeling it for you. I'm going to die at the hands of people who are going to win. the humanity, but in the long run, I will win. The gospel wins, not because of winning, but because of sacrifice and service. And Jesus adds this statement in verse 45. He says, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many." That's what I came for. He said, I didn't come as God to walk into this world and say, hey, a God is among you. He didn't come like Loki in the first Avengers movie saying, a God is among you, kneel before your God. That's my second Marvel reference today, by the way. You're welcome. He didn't come here and do that. Jesus, I didn't come to be served and say, everyone cater to me. God is among you. I came unassuming and unnoticed largely and let the good news spread, but I grew up in obscurity until I was ready to serve. And when I served, I served. And when people tried to make me their king, I resisted and ran away and I served. And while I served, the religious crowd hated me and they persecuted me and I let them because I got busy caring for others and sacrificing for others. And I'm going to die and give my life as a ransom for all of us. That's what following me looks like. Are you ready to sign up for that? But it's not like this world. It's not the way of this world. It's not the way of the religious world. I mean, very clear. When Jesus says it'll be different among you, he's not saying the religious way is better than the non-religious way. The gather in positions of authority and win and dominate was the way of the Pharisees and religious leaders of his day. Jesus was saying the religious world is as much bad as the regular world. I'm calling you to something very different. Service, sacrifice, walking in my steps and making a difference a completely upside down way. And that's the end of the story today. What do we take from that? What are the lessons from this story today? Well, there could be several. We could go really, really deep here. We could argue and say that maybe one of the lessons is don't be this guy.
Mama said that.
That could be a lesson, right? Don't be that guy, okay? That could be a takeaway, but I don't think it's the main takeaway, okay? So don't take that one home. But also don't be that guy. No, but here's what's the takeaway today. The takeaway is simply this, that serving is a pathway to leadership, and leadership is a platform for serving in the economy that Jesus introduced. That's what he calls us to. It's not the way of the world, but it's the way of the following Jesus. That serving is a pathway to leadership in his kingdom. What does that mean? I think one example that we could model at Lighthouse Church is choosing our deacons. We recently nominated Debbie Douglas to serve her second three-year term. Deacons serve three-year terms, have at least 1 year off before they can serve again. She's on her second term as a deacon starting last month. And we say every year when we do that process, we always say that we choose our deacons from people who are already serving. We don't look for people who are campaigning for the position, who have signs and are slandering their opponents across the church, right? Losers, all of them, I'm better. We don't play, that's not how we do it. We look for people who are serving without a title or the fanfare. And we say, if they show ability to lead and have organizational and directional spiritual depth and skills, we say, hey, you're serving. Would you mind serving in this role? And not a lot changes sometimes. Because the role sometimes is very directional. Sometimes the role is very much like, okay, you know, fix the big stuff, the annual stuff, the special stuff that comes up. If a church goes into crisis mode, who's going to steer the ship? And so they're there for important reasons. But honestly, they just keep serving. And when they step down from leadership, they serve down from that role, they often, like Nathan, just finish his term, still serving. Because that's what we want to always do. So that's not a church thing. That's a person thing. Serving is a pathway to leadership in God's economy, in God's kingdom. If you're living for a higher kingdom than this world, then serving is the pathway forward as a husband towards your wife, as a wife in your marriage, as a parent in your home. Serving is what God calls us to do. As an employer at your job, as an employee, as a friend in your friend circle, as a neighbor in your community, and as a member of your faith organization, we are called to look to serve. You say, well, I like to be called to lead. Serve. Serving is the pathway to leadership in God's economy. And here's the thing. When leadership does come, leadership is a platform for serving. That's what it's there for. And I know that this platform upon which we can serve is a high calling that many are like, I don't want that. I want that platform so people can serve me. That's the way the world does it. In fact, people, I'm not going to sign up for this Christianity stuff if that's how it's going to go. Because I'm a pretty privileged person in my life. I got a lot going my way. People answer to me. I'm the king of my home and my workplace, and I'm important. And I don't want to embrace this idea that Jesus is promoting because I want to use that power for my own good. Well, you know, you can reject that. But it doesn't really work, does it? It works for a while. But this kind of leadership is the most effective kind of leadership. And that kingdom mindset has changed the world. It has crept into the world. People are figuring this out. Not everyone. But it's better to be a leader that serves his people than a dictator. They said the difference between leaders and dictators, or leaders are loved and dictators are assassinated. I don't know if that's a good analogy, but all I know is that leadership, even in the corporate world, has started to figure out this idea. That's why they use the term servant leadership. It's almost like a overused term that people don't even mean anymore. It got really popular when many years ago, a man named Jim Collins, who's a great author, wrote a brand new book just recently. Jim Collins wrote a book called Good to Great. And in his book, he talks about the top companies in the world and the leaders of Fortune 500 companies that are the best of the best, that are great, not just good. And they have level 5 leaders, he says. And one of the characteristics of a level 5 leader, according to Jim Collins' research, is they are servant leaders. Well, that comes, and he literally quotes Jesus. He says, Jesus modeled this for us. Because the world figures out after a while that serving my own power is a bad recipe. You usually end up getting hated and dethroned over it. And even if you can keep power, you're miserable because you're selfish and you're on guard and you're angry. But people who let go of all of that and decide that I am here to follow the way of Jesus, I'm going to serve whether I have a position or not. And when I get a position of opportunity in life, it's just a bigger platform so I can serve even more. Those are the ones who are following the kingdom of God. And so, I want to close with a question and a simple piece of advice. You want status? Then choose service. If you're following Jesus, you can try it the other way. I will posit to you today that it's very unfulfilling in the end to serve yourself and to ask others to serve you. But if you want to do it, Jesus modeled for us. And by the way, Jesus' way changed the world. 2,000 years later, we're still talking about it. We're still singing about it. We're still praising it. We're still resting in it. And as Lindsay said earlier, we're finding our peace because of what Jesus did in service to us. If you want a better way to live in this world, the world will think you're crazy. The cross, the wisdom of the cross is foolishness to this world. But if you want to follow the Jesus' way, then choose service. And that's the call. Not just to believe on him. Not just to believe on him. The call is to follow him. And following Jesus will make your life better. And it will make you better at life. Not because it's always easy. Even when it's hard for following Jesus' path, it means more than the people who live an entire life of self-service and get everything they want by wrestling it down and never find peace and happiness inside their soul. And when you learn to live for something bigger than yourself and serve like Christ served us, even the hard times are laced with purpose and meaning. And it's what God honors, it's what Jesus models, and what we are called to do. So you want status? Let's choose service.